I guess a bit of a pun on Return to Point, which is a show that you did here a while back. Yeah, but 18 months ago. Was it that long ago?
2006.
Yeah.
So it would be 2 years.
And, you know, in terms of production, this is a markedly different work.
Yeah.
In terms of content, there's quite a seamless logic to it. Perhaps you could start speaking about the whole, departure from the production of Flash animation into this.
Yeah, okay. Technique. Yeah. Because the footage, the original footage shot in Venice, was... Like, I don't actually remember that night. Because we had drunk a lot of alcohol, but in particular a bottle of limoncello and spirits. That's it. I don't have any recall for that kind of drunk. So I found that footage about a month later, once we'd done it. And kind of laughed at it and dismissed it and then rethought about it. And I'd seen a work by Mike Kelly where he found a photograph of a high school play, and he had no other information apart from the photograph, but he then wrote a script and designed a set and put on a play based on that one image. And so I thought it'd be interesting, because I didn't remember having this idea, to extrapolate on that idea in the same way.
The idea is the deer in the snow.
Yeah.
So, are you saying that you weren't conscious of that moment in Venice as being the beginning of an artwork?
No, I wasn't. I mean...
So why was it being filmed?
The tourist.
Yeah, basically.
There's also a comment in that first section where one of the characters from the people sitting with you says, come in, can you do that whole to the viewers?
Yeah, and that's my partner, Emily. And we had gone out that night already really drunk and decided to
take... Sounds like a scam to me.
Yeah. And decided to take the camera. And we actually just did really crazy things, like... Because we couldn't find anything open, so we just started following people, hoping they were going to a party. And it turns out that most of them were just catching the last ferry home. But the camera just kept rolling, and then we found this bar, and because there's about an hour of footage, and this is just one part.
Who's this guy?
It's Merlin. He's a film editor who I'd hoped would help me edit, but he wasn't able to. But
he was too busy in Prague.
Yeah, he's too busy. But I grew up with him, and he just happened to be there.
So there's Scandinavia. What does that mean? What is that?
The sign actually says Scandinavia. The SCNA was broken.
Yeah.
But I didn't even realise that, I don't think.
It's the airline.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, I don't even know where this is. Friend actually does know where it is, and he told me, I'm like, oh, right. So back to Return to Point. So I thought, I wanted to show the work, I wanted to, there's quite a long process, but part of kind of validating the idea that I can't remember having was applying for the show. And seeing whether people would go for it, showing the same footage. I also applied for funding using the same footage. And
Which you didn't get.
Which I didn't get. And so, that was kind of, it did actually inform, like I hadn't written a script or anything at that point. And I originally envisaged it as more of a beer commercial. Like, there's a fantastic, it's Carlton Draft ad, shot in New Zealand with the mountains
big
and
ad.
With like the, yeah, this is a big ad,
yep.
A really big ad, that
yep.
one. So I wanted to shoot something really hyper-real and ridiculous like that, but because I didn't get the funding, I couldn't pull it off, which actually, I think, improved the idea because it brought about the script, so then I had to reassess it. And so it was called Return to Form, one, because of Return to Point, but also as a joke because it was nothing like Return to Point. And it was called Return to Form because I'm so unformally in the video. So it was kind of a joke.
But then there's also something located within this specific event in this space, whereas Return to Point sort of use that vehicle of the round shape to sort of return to, but apart from that it's all quite sort of random in a sense of exploration.
Yeah. I mean, there's a similar randomness to this, I guess, but...
Although it's an illustration of something specific.
It seems to have a similar kind of repetition of rhetorical catchphrases that I guess were illustrated by the animations but never actually articulated through speech or text. And that
true.
Seems to be kind of like the way you transposed it, or something.
Yeah, I think the characters became... the vehicles that were the animation were, in other words, the characters and the animations and the actual animations have been in the past.
I really like the idea of making a history out of what is essentially a black hole in your memory. And I wonder if that, I mean, thinking about it in relation to Return to Point and how you might feel about art history, I don't know if there's any parallel there. It's kind of, both of them seem to be purgatory. Spaces.
And I guess, like, the Australian, am I right in thinking this is a snow gum forest?
Yes.
In Australia,
it is. Yeah.
Yeah. That the Australian wilderness is often thought about as a kind of, non space or something that's kind of like a purgatory. Like, it's not beautiful or ugly, it's just kind of, you get lost in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, there's actually a line I kind of tried to allude to that when they discuss the bear asks why. In Australia, and the deer says to make here somewhere else, so it could be anywhere.
I mean, is there the connect with the European history? I mean, that stance where he's standing on the I mean, he goes into that ridiculous sort of rant about. So then you guys all sort of sit down together.
Yeah.
But I guess as the bear is fake, so too is the forest fake. Snow forest, because, pine forests look really different than snow
forest.
Are you conscious of the antlers being a formal kind of relationship to the tree form? Forest?
No, that kind of happened.
That's the most interesting thing for me. All that connect, that European connect and the explorer connect with the Australian bush.
Yeah,
because it is bush, but... So it's a very formal film, and to start when they're standing... the process and wondering about what's going to actually happen in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice. It's quite lovely. It's funny. And to see this formal construct of the antler. It's nice. And it's, for me, it's even more so emphasised by, a deer and a bear together. I mean, it's an unusual combination, a marriage.
Yeah.
But, and then I'm thinking, they should have sex. But they didn't. I enjoyed it. It was beautiful.
The bodily function.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
Not have sex. I mean, they could make love or
it's
something.
It's my partner.
Where's the reference to her bodily function?
So this is your partner?
Yeah.
In the bear suit. And this is this you?
No.
Oh, right.
I didn't think it was you.
No, but the I guess if...
See, look at all those branches.
Yeah.
The camouflage is pretty pronounced.
And it's shot with
it's quite monochromatic.
So this is process, isn't it? It has something nice comes out of process.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they're talking about at that point, too.
Yeah.
But there is this mention of sort of the Eurocentric and Anthony Gardner mentioned his sort of judgment was provincial. And then you spit out the door before we substantiate that. I guess I wonder how you feel about that in terms of the specific references to, we've talked official advice, obviously, various other European American references, and the setting, the Venice setting, everything that's just been brought up now.
It's Australian. Like, I'm very aware of the fact that it is provincial. Like, I think it's almost, I actually think it has quite a relationship to The Pioneer Meets the Wanderer, which was the piece I did at Heidi, because of that provincialism. Like, it's constricted by the fact that I work here in Australia. Defined by.
I'm pretty sure that Scandinavia would be considered quite provincial by some people as well.
Yeah.
Like, in some ways, of kind of, locating a provincial everywhere or something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it.
But you're kind of talking about a space that doesn't exist. And, I mean, right from the beginning, like, it's a myth. It's something where half of the letters are missing. And to have, Caspar David Friedrich's The Wanderer in the middle of Lake Mountain is exactly that space.
Mm.
So it wouldn't have worked at all if you'd shot it in Scandinavia.
No, well, I think that was what was great about it, me not getting the funding and stuff, because it meant that it became defined by the limits, basically.
Yeah.
And that provincialism, even though it is a non-space to a degree, it can't help but somehow influence.
Is it a one-day shoot?
2-day
shoot.
Just on that, just to finish that revision, I think it's very knowing in the whole work. I mean, you decide to cut it, but I'm going there tomorrow.
Yeah.
To Prague.
Well, it's because,
Scandinavian,
that
Prague.
Australian pilgrimage.
Lake Mountain, it sort of doesn't matter.
And isn't it wonderful that it's called Lake Mountain?
Yeah, it's
the greatest name. It's like only in Australia could there be a mountain named Lake Mountain.
But, like, the climax to the narrative when, the deer is, sticking his antlers into the, nether or whatever, but the singing is really, I really separated it, the Endonavia, I didn't see it as a, hear it as a place, I separated it into three words, that were kind of maybe Latin derived of n as in in, and then den as in, a kind of dative, location, and then navia as, some sort of maybe, a reference to snow, a word for snow or something. So it's he's kind of reveling in the snow, this kind of formless bliss,
I guess formless bliss is, for me that was a punchline and a kind of, the climax where a kind of Indonesian reached, or maybe a Nirvana.
Or, as Stuart said, a Narnia.
But there's definitely...
Well, it's a Narnia, if I miss that, because I can't relate, but it's the faith in your imagination, the faith in that black spot that you do source a lot of work from, I think, and owning that and actually putting it out there as part of the secret experiment. What happened in my subconscious was actually... in control, and mediate it. And that is what Narnia is about too. It's about children going to that place
as an escape.
As well, bringing it into a reality that can help them survive. And that's why I enjoy it a lot, is because it is about that, that common faith that we have in this practice that we try and make. So, and it can be terrifying. Putting yourself drunk on screen and they feel quite terrified.
But there's something that I think that's really true, but there's something really counter to that as well in this work, which I've found in all people work. Is it, you know, and Rebecca Cull's pointed this out quite eloquently, that there's the same mechanized distance in the work that there was. I mean, this figures may as well be flash animation stick figures, and that everything just becomes a vehicle for this sort of distancing.
So, I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, it was just a comment that was thrown out.
Yeah. What do you mean by distance?
When you look at a stick figure flash animation on those previous ones, it's mechanized.
Yeah.
You're not identifying the character as such. It's a cipher.
Yeah.
I think her point was that these are not so much characters as the same mechanized ciphers that we're used to in your practice.
Yeah, I think.
Are they supposed to be different? Is it just something to do with that?
I think she's looking for some type of bridge.
I think it's about Arlo's practice having just, relaxed into different form. I don't think it's necessarily. I see it as a really similar language, and it's more just a, sort of liberation from.
Yeah, relaxed from flash animation.
Yeah, but but of course it's the same content. Like, people don't sort of go, now I'm going to, explore. I mean, that's why it's such a nice little shaft between that first scene and then this one. I don't really understand why that would be.
The humans, subtler in this.
Yeah.
It still is arduous. It's going up to the sky, pumping around and freezing to death. It's got the same awe as, he sat there and animated and flash all these sort of intricacies. It's got a similar sort of detail in some way. It's just different rendering.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
And the narrative does what you used to do with imagery a lot more, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think the script definitely functions in the same way as the animations do, like as a mechanism in the same way.
Yeah, they're very sort of circular. They remind me of sort of cogs that fit into other cogs. The conversation is clever and circular, and especially the conversation when they're talking about the funding. Inevitability of that. There's the knowledge is in it, so it makes them a person, like a sort of familiarity as well.
My question is more about how you deal with that thing, anxiety of influence, like the markers being so pronounced.
Yeah.
How do you choose your markers, or why do you choose your markers, or why are they interesting to choose in the first place?
Well, I made them really obvious because I like to kind of wear my references on my sleeve.
I'm not saying do you have an anxiety about the influence.
Yeah.
So that's what it was sort of called, appropriation-wise, and that you go and you go and move into that territory. You do it so sort of seamlessly. Like knowing that this would, the Weasel of Shealy film and the psychedelic aspect of that film and the way that dialogue is, and then the way that you made this version of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of tricky that you go to that edge when you don't necessarily need to. There's enough in your work not to.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't really understand the question. Maybe I don't have to. I'm just trying to understand. Like, so you're talking about the psychedelic edge in this practicing filmmaking.
Or why the references
are so
why are they so obvious?
They're not that. It must be naive. It's not very obvious for me.
Well, the Weasel-Shealy film is pretty sort of down that track to this
film. I've seen a heap of their work, but I don't sort of.
You haven't seen the rat, the friend, they're walking through the snow, and then they walk through the desert, and they have these conversations about the content of art, and they mention things similar about the responsibility of form, and then there's this romantic soundtrack going over the top. And you know this film. You must have seen this film.
I haven't. Because
I've been making animations about them for
When you rang me and said there's reference Swiss artists, I mean, I'm looking at it and thinking, oh, bear, it's a white bear, it's like the British artist, a take on the British artist, Brown Bear.
Oh, I think Mark Wallinger.
The Wallinger.
Yeah.
So,
I'm a fan of
that. I've seen a lot of Fish Lip Vice or whatever, but I don't know. I haven't seen that.
Sort of second most famous work beyond the, the way things are. Most famous work.
Go get that from the library.
Anyway, I think David's question is fair. There's a fairly strong, reference to anyone.
Yeah,
but
that's not unusual for Pollard.
Why did I do that? I guess to a degree, it's a certain security in using an existing trope.
It's a beautiful homage. It's not,
but I mean, I think that's because they kind of provide symbols or markers as to how I'm investigating. It's kind of like I adopt certain philosophies of other works, and so to investigate what I'm trying to do. And that's so the references are really simple.
It's a very powerful lens, that reference is a very powerful lens to sort of have this thing occur.
I think what it does is actually make this work like a description of a work in the same way that, it's a similar way to how, Lawrence Wiener and Joseph Seuss work, but sort of like descriptions of their own works.
Yeah.
You've used other people's language to make a description of your own work, which is then presented as this kind of blissful snow, nothing, there's nothing actually there, but it's so full and rich and charged and fragile because it's snow, because it's melting.
I think that they're kind of like, especially the Fishly and Vise and also the Wanderer reference, which is a really kind of obvious one, they kind of adopted philosophies that I use to inform the work.
Do you find with that, when you use these sort of things as symbols, that you can pick them up and leave them as they go? Because I sort of feel that some of the references could almost be interchangeable in any of their variations. So it becomes almost a personal symbol or something that, like a record of how you were thinking and feeling.
Yeah.
In this black hole origin moment.
Yeah.
I mean, is there something? The man's only one sticking in my head that's very important, but could also probably be interchangeable with other things if you had to make this work in a year or previously.
I use the man's only one in lots of works, and each time it kind of has a different take, it's a different reason for using it. And same with the Fishly and Vise as well. And the Wanderer. and they are representative of the kind of how art. They just end up being artists that I'm kind of interested in when I'm making the work.
Yes.
They're the ones I look to kind of. And even Stuart's work. The whole, I was really unsure about showing the drunken footage in Stuart. I looked at Stuart's practice on Stuart's. Quite happy to embarrass himself. So it kind of helped inform it. And also, I left Bruni kind of.
Couldn't these specific references throughout be a sort of metaphor for the whole, paralysis, this removal of authorship, this where do I position myself as an author, as an artist? Drunkenness is another way of doing it, I guess.
Yeah.
Just like Kel's block of ice. Why aren't you holding your ball?
I had to go to the bar again.
Yeah. You know, I just wonder how you sort of feel about that, about, you know, embarking on a new artwork and how you position yourself within it now and how you feel as an author and removing traces of that authorship, you know, detachment, involvement, all these things come to mind, I think of perhaps not only your practice, but a lot of contemporary art practice and your generation.
Certainly that detachment, like, I mean, I don't know if I would have made the work if I'd remembered having the idea, because I probably would have written the idea off.
You know, it's almost like you're sort of referencing yourself, you know.
I mean, about it being like a description of his artwork.
Yeah, like, it's not like you're really searching, or it's like you're parodying the search.
Yeah. It's funny because it actually was thinking that it's sort of taking the format of a spoof, and then like the drunken bit's like a blooper. Like,
yeah, funny. Yeah. But I don't know.
That's interesting. You were looking at Mike Kelly. I was like, do you know? Because he's made works in reverse of that too, where he started with his absent memories. Like,
yeah.
I was thinking about the one he did with his high school movement and. From his faulty memories of his high school, he recreated scale models to the way his memory worked, not the way the building actually functioned.
Yeah.
So obviously there was, you know, missing doors and hallways are all blocked off, and some rooms were 10 kilometres wide and some, you know, into, and were just these kind of faulty memory maps, like, which were full of absences and gaps, and just kind of like all maps are, really.
Hmm.
Maybe.
Or even a polar bear in a snowstorm looks like something.
Yeah.
You know, I can't draw, you know? So I'm left with a white blank canvas. It still looks like something. So really, the postman in the dark park.
The polar bear.
Yeah. Oh, just the whole thing about the size of the screen, relationship to the walls in the gallery. The way that you move from this wall to that wall from the last show.
Yeah, I thought that was important.
It's a really nice clip. And the rugs. Right.
You like the rugs?
Yeah, I like the rugs.
You know, I think it's like kind of like a cinema, but then it's not completely immersive, because if you wanted it to be kind of like, yeah, like you were in the place, it would have been the whole...
Yeah.
Like floor to ceilings.
But I think
it's more like a drive-in
feel.
Or something.
Yeah. Why were you so interested in making that sort of a prop, example, and still holding on to the installation component? I guess it's interesting in relation to say David Rosicky shows some how he's completely dropped the installation.
And yeah.
You know, that move to sort of complete. Similar experience.
I think it was a gesture, really. Like, I mean, the screen was.
It's ham, isn't it? I mean, the.
Like
ham.
Yeah, it's like a hammed up kind of. Was it
Joe? Yeah.
No, it works fine.
You can't take it too seriously. Have a cinematic experience when you're trying to keep yourself.
I don't think the film is a cinematic experience.
No.
It's shot like a cinematic. I hope.
Because the sound comes, it's not behind you.
No.
Like, I struggled. I had to sort of go to this corner to kind of
yes.
to listen.
Is this like Déjeuner sur l'Heure? Like,
yeah.
They kind of
sure.
Naked polar bear.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why I wrote the picnic in. It seemed the obvious thing to do.
There was that explaining voice that was coming up, you know, so it came into play at the right sort of place.
Yeah.
You get the reference. It was that romantic voice that's going to do it.
Yeah.
Talk about responsibility of form and great utopian ideals. And that your ideas take you in a direction. You pick the right, you know, the right mark, the right vehicle.
Relational aesthetic.
Yeah.
But I'm waiting for that direct stare at the viewer. Just doesn't.
Well, I thought the music kind of would do that or something. Like
I could see that polar bear, but it's just a little bit.
Like, it's supposed to, like, it's, we recorded all the dialogue separately and we recorded the music separately. And I kind of wanted it to be like a layers, like, because the dialogue's quite disassociated and then the and the music's completely almost bombastic. It's over the top.
What you're really saying is it's fucking crazy. You got more of that with me.
Yeah, then we're drinking whiskey. Yeah. That was the other thing, I had to convince a choir to sing for it.
It's funny because actually, that disassociation thing, I think unless you did have the, you know, why you were polar bear, like those specific references to what you're watching,
yeah,
you would just think it was random footage that was kind of...
With dialogue over the
yeah
top. Yeah. Because even though we recorded, like filmed him speaking, all the dialogue kind of put in afterwards. It was mostly, because... Even when we were filming, it was informing. For example, him having not being able to do the strap up on the helmet. Like, he could do it up, but it was too heavy. Like, it kind of was easier for him to balance it. So that became part of the way he acted in that.
He digs up the snow on the way up and throws it.
Yeah. So all of that became part of the process. Right?
And the rain was...
You know, I think the Narnia reference is actually stronger than it would otherwise have been. It's because Juan definitely, like in the drawing,
yeah,
he definitely looks like he's wearing fairy pants. Mm. Like,
yeah. They're actually zebra pants. No, giraffe pants.
And that little, like, what do you call it? Brian Coyne salt?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a genre? Sorry, I'm wrong. It took me a while to work out they're actually singing the title.
Yeah.
How did you commission that?
Well, the sound design and the we decided to do that because we wanted something to kind of just
break the film.
Break it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And because the original title is Scandinavia, so it's, let's do something in the sense of kind of Scandinavian.
It's the porn image, yeah.
Now the stick person's done all the album covers.
Yeah. And so we wrote a piece of music, and he screamed into an ear into a microphone, and we kind of worked on it until it sounded right. I mean, it would have been nice to get a death metal group to do it.
Yeah.